Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello, this is Tim Reedy for the America Magazine podcast for the week of May 18th, and very happy to have with us Mr. Robert Sullivan, the author. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Now, Bob is the author of many books, including A Whale Hunt, The Meadowlands, Rats, and the new book, The Thoreau You Don't Know. Now, there's a lot of things we can talk about today, but I thought we'd lead off with your current book, as I said, The Thoreau You Don't Know. Maybe you could talk about, you've quoted Thoreau in a number of your books, but why? What prompted you to actually revisit it and write a book about him at this point?
Well, it was an accidental book. I didn't want to write it. Like most of my books, I don't want to write them. I try to get to a point where I won't have to write them, and then if I can't get to that point, then I end up having to write them. Thoreau, I kept running into him, and every time I'd write a book, it would get billed as, you know, about the environment, which is great. You know, if you write a book, you want somebody to call it something that's better than the opposite or the alternative, which is nothing, which is bad. So environment is good, nature book, that kind of thing. And I started looking more and more at Thoreau as the sort of champion nature writer, as the ultimate nature writer, and Walden being kind of, you know, the great nature book, the American nature book. And I realized that I thought I had him right. I thought I had him kind of figured out, but I had it all wrong. I had Thoreau kind of backwards.
Yeah, that's what's fascinating me about, you know, you sent me the introduction and I read it. I think of Thoreau as a nature writer, but as you write, that's sort of a limiting description of him.
So limiting. So, you know, it comes down to, I've been working on my high school essay question for my whole entire life. I'll never graduate, ever. And it's sort of what, you know, describe man versus nature in blah, blah, blah. And this is what I think academics sometimes call it, a false binary. It's a false binary. It's a bad setup. And it's a setup that is sadly intrinsic in so much of our conversation about the world. We say, there's nature, and here we are over here. And the more, you know, the closer I got to really digging into Thoreau, I mean, I could already smell before I started writing about Thoreau that he was not there, that he was not saying it's two separate columns. And it's funny, I read a book about Wordsworth last week, and it started out, it was a very academic book, very intense book. I had to put it down and walk around the block after every chapter. My brain's not that nuanced, not that sophisticated, but it started out saying, hey, before we go anywhere, don't think of nature as elements and vines and branches and Sierra Club posters. Think of nature as, not that those things aren't included in nature, but think of nature, when you're thinking about the transcendentalist, as human nature. Think of the nature that Thoreau is talking about primarily, firstly, as human nature. And so, you know, immediately you can get from Thoreau to Karl Rahner, you know, in about 20 seconds.
Well, we'll pick up on that later, and it's a theme that you explore in many of your books. But one interesting aspect of Thoreau's life is that, you know, we think of a man who kind of lived in solitude, away from community. But as you point out, relationships, community life was important to him. What evidence is there to support that?
Well, to put it most succinctly, something I have trouble doing always, his life. I mean, absolutely his life. And yeah, so Thoreau is positioned, the way we think of him today, he's positioned as a hermit, as a faraway guy, as a guy who moves off into a cabin and out in the quote-unquote wilderness, when in fact he did not do that. And that is problematic to say that because the way we think about Thoreau now, he's got a kind of a myth-bust aspect to him. So in other words, when the conversation turns to Thoreau nowadays, I mean, for our generations, people say, aha, Thoreau. Yeah, I heard that he cheated. I heard that he went in for dinner with his family on Thursday. I heard that he actually lived close to town. Now, when Thoreau was writing, he was doing all kinds of parody and satire about people moving away into the wilderness, about hermits, newspapers were writing about them all the time. He was critiquing the associationists, Brook Farm, people trying to start a new community, a new life, something he really respected. He was doing a kind of new community of one, and he was doing it kind of on the edge of town. He was not. He was purposefully not leaving, not going away, and he was purposefully trying to stay in touch with his family, with town, with community. He was about community. He was saying that you have to recharge yourself to be a part of the community. Now, so that I have taken this really impossible and ridiculous and frankly dumb task. I'm trying to myth bust a guy who's, you know, intrinsically got a myth busting element to him. So people say, you know, no, I know the real Thoreau, and I say, no, I know the real Thoreau, and it becomes a nightmare. But his entire life is living in one place and you know, getting to know people.
Yeah, I mean, and part of that myth busting is looking at his most famous book, Walden. And as you say, the way you read it is as a device to kind of incite the reader to change the world and not simply to withdraw from society. Maybe you can cite an example from the book here.
Well, I mean, there's tons of examples. And of course, example, I mean, frankly, it becomes kind of like, you know, prayer. I mean, Walden, we look at it today and people comb through it and say, now let's see. Did he drive a Prius, or did he drive an SUV that had a, you know, was it solar powered, or, you know, and oh, by the way, he was cheating, and so, you know, you really don't have to drive a Prius, you know, because he was a cheater. So we're looking at it as a prescription, Walden, when in fact it's more like, you know, it's really a place, an imaginary place that you go to, and that it allows you to look and think about your life. So for instance, people say, He farmed beans, people say. And now people can kind of attack him for farming beans and say, oh, the bean was a non-native species of bean. And that was a big mistake on his, you know, it shows that he didn't know what he was talking about in terms of the environment. But when Thoreau is farming beans, he's actually talking about, kind of critiquing, the idea that local farmers are trying to make more and more money. They're losing money because cheaper farm goods are coming from out of town. So they're giving up farming in their community, and people are now having to import food and pay more for imported food because there is no local food. And people are, generally speaking, getting caught up in kind of market economics that are screwing up the local community. And he is saying, look, I'm farming beans. And what do beans represent in antebellum America? The word itself means nothing, as in I'm making beans. So he's saying, look, I'm having a life, a real life. I'm able to live, and I'm making beans. Get it? It's a joke. And when he said that, people were in hysterics at lectures. But now we say, oh, he's a fraud. I mean, people on the sort of environmental side, if you will say they weren't native plants. And people on the kind of the side that, you know, laughs at environmental concerns and says, ha, green jobs, we need jobs, that they get it wrong because they say he's a fraud.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the interesting things about your book is that you reveal Thoreau to be someone who, you know, was, as you say, wrote parodies and had a real sense of humor.
Humor is a big problem. And it's a big problem everywhere in the world. There's sadly a lack of humor when, of course, there's plenty of humor around. We just don't use it as much as we should, I would argue. But definitely in terms of talking about ecology and the environment, humor is a problem.
Yeah.
Also religion, prayer, life. As I mentioned earlier, there's not enough humor in life.
Now, as you were saying, what you write in your introduction, in some ways when we put or we imagine Thoreau to be this kind of man living in solitude away from community, it's easier for us to say, okay, well, he's kind of unapproachable. There's no way we could ever live that life. So, but you're making the argument that, in fact, the life he lived is something that we could actually follow.
Yeah, well, because the move to a cabin, living in a cabin, which he didn't call a cabin, he called it a house, that's a temporary thing. I mean, frankly, if you want to look at the facts of his life, he went there to work on another book. He wrote another book while he was there. He was there for 2 years. And it's because he wanted to move out of his parents' house. His parents had a boarding house because there's a huge economic, you know, recession then. Believe it or not, speculators were being blamed by the public for destroying the banking system. There had been a bubble that popped. It wasn't a housing bubble, though. It was actually, I think, a wheat bubble. You know, there wasn't a lot of money. I mean, money, the recession. There were actually guys writing books. There was a guy writing a book in upstate New York, and he saw a lot of businessmen living on a lake. And they were not living there by choice. They had lost their jobs on Wall Street. So Thoreau goes to this cabin. It's kind of, you know, he's looking for a workspace, and he goes to write this book. And he's basically saying, I'm going to go back. I'm going back. I'm just cutting out for a second to write this book up. But I'm putting these ideas down, because these then give us a way to go back. You know, we can use these back at home or back in our regular everyday workspace. We can use these ideas to figure out how to live a quote unquote good life. And so he's joking about living seriously, and he's serious about living kind of in a more humorous, fun way. Jokes are hard; they don't travel through history. It's hard to pick up jokes. So, but he's very serious about levity, and he's silly about seriousness. And you know, these are really important. But I think the to answer your question, or to attempt to finally answer your question, I would say that Thoreau basically doesn't say, you know, here's what car to drive, and here's what food to buy, and here's what clothes to import from here because it's this. Thoreau gives you the kind of tool to say, am I driving the car, or is the car driving me? Am I living a life, or am I one of the mass of people who are just suffering through life and doing what they think they're supposed to do because they're following the trend?
Now, correct me if I'm wrong here, but it seems to me that at least in some way you're looking at Thoreau through a Catholic lens, because, you know, community, solidarity, these are important Catholic values. People are important. So is engagement with the larger world. Am I incorrect in this kind of interpretation?
Well, as you know, if you're Catholic, it's hard to look at anything and not have a Catholic eye. But no, absolutely. I mean, this is his deal. He is talking about how you have to step back and figure out who you are and your contribution. Your personhood contributes to this larger, greater society. So, in other words, part of the deal is reforming society, and this is what they're all about, pre-Civil War America. But he says that to truly reform, you have to stop and figure out who you are and what you are, and reform yourself. I mean, the guy's, you know, the guy sounds like he's writing for the Catholic worker in 1850, which is tough because it doesn't exist yet, the Catholic worker. But he talks, I mean, Dorothy Day talks about, you know, these banks have mortgages on us. And Thoreau makes all kinds of jokes about how the home owns you. And really, why don't you set up something simple? Set up your life so that you own your life. I mean, mortgage comes from, I think, death pledge is what it literally means, right?
Wow.
So you have to think about that. We don't have to.
Now, let's turn to Thoreau, the writer. Now, you describe him at one point as kind of a proto-Joyce. He loved wordplay. How has he influenced your own writing? You know, I find your writing, you know, you like wordplay. I'm thinking of a piece you wrote for the Times Magazine about the director Todd Haynes last year and his movie about Bob Dylan. So what have you learned from him as a writer?
The one piece that he had is kind of most severe. He wrote a piece called Life with Principle. That title is a joke. It's not about, well, everybody's talking about the economy at that point, and what do I get when I put down this principle? What kind of interest will I get? So he's talking about a life with a principle, and that's a bit of a joke there. But he basically tries to tell people what to do, and I know that you can't do that. You can't. Every time I've tried to write something like that, I get a similar reception to what Thoreau got for that piece, which is people fall asleep and get upset with you. You know, I don't feel a kind of kinship with his writing. I feel I'm interested in thinking about his writing life. Here was a guy who worked really hard to write in a way that was accessible, but some of the biggest points he was making, he kind of, I don't want to say snuck them in, but he kind of you know, put them in ways that they didn't hit people over the head. Maybe they might get it a little bit later, and that I think is a really fun thing, and that probably you could say characterizes. If you said my books could be characterized, which they probably can't be, that's kind of it. Because, you know, For instance, I wrote a book about the New Jersey Meadowlands and the swamps, and they're disgusting, gross, and polluted, and there's mob guys who are suspected of being buried out there. But really the theme was, the theme for me is how do you care for uncared for landscapes or places or things or people? And thus the Hopkins poem, God's Grandeur, is my theme song / poem for most of my books.
Yeah, why don't we talk about some of your earlier books? In the Meadowlands, you actually start with a quote from God's Grandeur. And this is... It's unexpected because you're writing about this place that most people, you know, just drive by on the New Jersey Turnpike and never take a second look at. I know I haven't until I read your book. But what is it about these places, the Meadowlands? You also wrote this famous book about rats and their inhabitants here in New York City. What is it about this intersection between the natural world and the live world that fascinates you?
You know, I think I quote, it's true, the book starts with the lines from Hopkins, but I think there's also the Secaucus animal control person who, or is it Secaucus?
The health department, animal control officer of the health department, Secaucus, New Jersey. I'll read it here. I'll tell you one thing. If you dig out here, you sure as heck are going to find something.
And that, to me, is just about as magical as, I mean, it really is as magical as, you know, God's grandeur. I mean, the world is charged with the grandeur of God. I mean, doesn't that kind of say it in another way? I think it does. So, you know what? Don't answer that question. I think there's two things. One is opposites, and the other is seeing what's not cared for. And I think those are two great things that you get, two great challenges you get if you're Catholic. And one is that... that you find the kind of divine in what seems not divine, that you find that the sacred and the profane exist very close next to each other, that you might ride through one to get to the other, and so on and so forth. And that's, you know, in disgusting places, so-called disgusting places, great. We're really good at caring for pristine, wildflower-covered meadows. We can rally people up and say, "Hey, let's save that meadow and not put a garbage dump there." But what about, you know, places that nobody, like I say, cares about? What about the people who live next to the garbage dump because their community is considered not to be, you know, worth saving?
Right. I mean, it seems like both in Meadowlands and in Rats that you're sort of making the argument that it's impossible to kind of draw a fine line or a bright line between the natural world and the live world. Is that they're always commingling, and any attempt to kind of, you know, colonize the natural world, the natural is going to fight back at some point.
Right, and that there, you could argue that there's no distinction. Yeah. I mean, there's this great, you guys had a great piece in the anniversary issue by, is it Elizabeth Johnson?
Elizabeth Johnson, yes.
And there's this idea that Christ is corporeal. I mean, you know, that real presence is really present everywhere. I mean, present in the world. I mean, the world is charged with, to quote, you know, what's his name again? The grandeur of God. I mean, it's all there. You can't say that he came into part of this and part of that. He came into the entire world. And it's a challenge to, we're really good at saying, I love this, preserve this, this is great, I'm going to build a country house there. But the challenge is, how do you embrace and love the land that's, you know, that's trod upon?
Right. I mean, when you were writing the Meadowlands, you weren't living out here, right? You were living on the West Coast at the time?
I was living in a really beautiful part of Oregon, up in beautiful mountains.
But you felt compelled to come back.
And every time I'd look out the view, I'd say, this is really terrific. This is wonderful, easily beautiful. But what about that really amazing landscape out there that's, here I go again, that's bleared, how does it go? Bleared with trade, smeared with, I'm trying to find the
Hopkins
thing. Yeah,
that's a good...
You know, that's, I think Hopkins was writing about New Jersey, I'm pretty sure.
Even though he was in England and never came to the States, but...
That we know of. That we can prove.
But he knew New Jersey.
Generations have trod, all is seared with trade, bleared, smeared with toil, and wears man's smudge and shares man's smell. The soil is bare now. Yeah.
So even in places like the swamps of the Meadowlands and the rats, there is some sort of spark of the divine.
Well, rats is really, really interesting because... you know, and I was thinking, what could I write? What could I write a nature book about? What subject could I take? I just written about whales, and everybody and their uncle comes to save whales.
Right.
They come running out. No, you got to save the whales. There's Native American community, 75% unemployment, kids dying of drug abuse, and but people come up and say, no, stop, Native Americans, don't hunt a whale. This is what the whale hunt book's about. Don't hunt a whale because whales are special and precious, and we must save them. Well, where was everybody, you know, 3 weeks ago before they talked about whales trying to help the Native American community that's also precious and special and was having serious problems? So I thought, what's the creature I could write about that would not have people coming in and picketing and saying, save the blank? What's the creature that, you know, no one would say, oh, I want to ride the back of it and in a lagoon and swim with it? And that is rats.
Correct.
And yet rats are, if you can say that a grizzly bear needs a range of, they always talk about 100 miles of non-human, you know, no human population. I mean, unless the bears are eating garbage at Yellowstone. But if you can talk about grizzly bears, their habitat defines or says no people. The opposite is to be said of rats. That is, rats exist only where there are people. They exist because of people. They eat our stuff. And so to see a rat is really to see, it's a sign of a human presence.
And that book is Rats, Observations on the History and Habitat of the City's Most Unwanted Inhabitants. And this has got a great cover, which you said your daughter, this was one, her idea.
My daughter, she was reading a lot of Peter Cease, who's an amazing illustrator who did a great drawing of a map slash whale of Central Park that was in the New York City subways for many years and gone now. And so she said, oh, maps, rats.
And he incorporated the rat into the landscape of Manhattan. So
the rat is the city. The city is the people.
Now, you live right now in Brooklyn, but as you said, you've lived out in Oregon. You've lived in small towns. What brought you back to the city? Why New York?
Oh, boy. I don't know. I mean, I'm from here. I was having to travel a lot here when I wasn't here because, you know, reporting, it's hard. It's tough to make a living. I mean, I'm writing for magazines. It's easier to pieces locally. I don't know. I miss Oregon. I don't know. It's all good.
Is there a way as a city dweller that you can stay connected with nature, even if you are in, you know, the most populous city?
Well, if you think the city is natural, mm-hmm. I guess that's a big thing for me with Thoreau, is that Thoreau is not saying we must all live rurally in faraway places. Thoreau is, in fact, celebrating communal living, and kind of he's a proto-urban guy in a way. So if you think of the city as a natural thing, which I do, which I'm sort of trying to prove with a couple of books, then absolutely. And of course, if you think about sustainability, about trying to live in a way that doesn't impinge upon other people. In fact, if you replace the word environment and use instead the word health, suddenly you're talking about your health and the health of people in general, then the city becomes an absolutely natural way to live, a sort of relevant, sustainable way for humans to live, because we can't spread ourselves across, you know, in giant dwelling places across the entire landscape.
Yeah, in terms of sustainable living, you address some of these issues in this book, this small book you wrote, How Not to Get Rich or Why Being Bad Off Isn't So Bad. Maybe you could just describe that book quickly for our listeners.
Well, that book's just about that preceded the recession, I'm proud to say. It's just this idea of why do we want everything we want? There's so much that we have that's free, that's great. And another big thing about Thoreau is that in his time, there was song, there was music. When you go back to Thoreau's journals, the landscape that he lives in, first of all, there are no trees. They've cut them all down. And by the way, they grew back, which I don't want to get into, but it's an amazing thing. But second of all, you don't hear this perfect quiet that we think of with nature and Thoreau and flower poems. No, you hear shotguns and cows mooing and people laughing and boys beating trees for chestnuts and logging. You know, logging so that the trees grow back so they can continue to log. But also you hear over and over people singing at night, at parties, at homes, people singing during the day while they work. And that kind of soundtrack to life, that simple, completely free thing, except in church. You know, that's one of the reasons, you know, I go to church because they let me sing. People so far, you know, I'm knocking on wood. Can I knock on wood? So far, have allowed me to continue to sing.
You're a Catholic who does sing. That's good.
I don't want to, scare people, but yeah.
No, maybe we can end. You know, you're a graduate of Georgetown University, and I understand you're a former student of the Jesuit Otto Hentz down there.
That's right.
Maybe you can talk about, you know, how that experience has shaped you. We've talked a little bit about it, and what you've chosen to write about.
I'd have to get into the molecular structure of my brain, which is probably really, really simple compared to other brains. But that course, oh my gosh, him talking about Karl Rahner, I think I've only mentioned Rahner about 80 times. I'm sure you'll edit it down to 70 times.
This was a course on Rahner that Otto Hentz taught at Georgetown.
Yeah, and that course, that's pretty much, I don't see how anything could have had less of an influence. I mean, just thinking, well, can I get this?
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You can look at your notes.
Wait, I brought some Rahner lineage. We are human beings only within humanity. I mean, this is really what Walden is about. He's not saying we're human beings only, you know, within birds. He's talking about association and how we associate with people. Now, he is saying that, you know, we have a place in the world that's about, frankly, that to me, I mean, when you think about, you know, death and sacrifice and stepping back as being a way to open yourself up, then you sort of, it leads you to the question of, oh yeah, and can humanity step back from the world and say, oh, we have to kind of take a smaller place in the kind of physical world. In other words, we can't throw our junk everywhere. I mean, you can take that in a lot of different places, but also just this great line, our experience of ourselves occurs in unity with the experience of others. If we have the latter, then we have the former, but whoever does not find the neighbor is also not truly present to himself. I guess rats is kind of about that, because rats, God help us all that I'm talking about rats and Karl Rahner, but rats is secretly a book about the city and about how groups of people make the city and how that's a good thing. I mean, to think not about individuals so much as groups and how, you know, how people make up groups.
Well, we'll end there, but we want to thank Bob Sullivan for coming in from his home in Brooklyn. And we, you know, good luck with the book. It's called The Thoreau You Don't Know, What the Prophet of Environmentalism Really Meant. It's published by HarperCollins, and we want to thank you for coming.
Well, thanks for having me.
I want to thank you again for joining us for the American Magazine podcast. Just a reminder that you can now play our podcast on our homepage by just scrolling down on the left-hand side. And you can also go to americamagazine.podbean.com to either download or subscribe to our iTunes feed. I want to thank Bill McGarvey, who provided music for this week's show. You can learn more about him at billmcgarvey.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.